feels other world. And boy, this is out of the world. This is going to be interesting. It's about a book called Amphibians, Reptiles, Birds, and Mammals of Western Mexico. You might not have even known there are amphibians, reptiles, birds, and mammals in Western Mexico. The man who wrote the book, Petra Miska, is on the phone. I'm a great lover, as you know, Petra, of Mexico. And people tend to go there for vacation, which is great. They may go to Cancun or Puerto Vallarta or, I don't know, wherever they happen to go just to hang out at the beach. All of that is terrific. It turns out there's a lot of wildlife in Mexico.
To say the least. Hey, Steve, how are you? How's it going?
I'm good, thank you. So I want to talk about some of that wildlife, and some of it would be more difficult for your average tourist to find because it's in the rainforest, away from people.
Yes, but you were absolutely right. People come to Mexico, and many times they run into the animals just on the doorstep of the hotel or on the beach or when they're driving at night. So it's really not difficult to see and appreciate the nature in Mexico because it's right there. Yes, so, of course, there are some species that you need to, get out a bit and look for, and you have to know where to look and so on. But you can enjoy nature without being much of a specialist.
And you're a superb photographer. I mean, that's what you do. So I want to talk about photographing nature wherever you see it, whether it be in Mexico or your own backyard, or whether it be in an exotic place like Belize or Africa or wherever it may be. But when I think of the animals of Mexico in part, I think two things. I think of the parrots first. There are so many variety of parrots in Mexico. And sadly, as I understand it, many of them are quickly disappearing.
Yeah, that's unfortunately true. And that's mostly because of two factors. One of them is that we are not taking care of their home very well. So we are disappearing the forests where they live. And the other one is exactly because they are attractive. They are animals that are visually very pleasing and they are funny and people like to keep them at home. And that, unfortunately, fuels a lot of the wildlife trade. So here on the West Coast, where it's my home, we have several species that have been really decimated over the last decades because of poaching. People go, they cut down the tree where the young chicks are being incubated, and they just take them away and sell them.
That still goes on? I thought that so I know that importing live parrots into America, for example, is illegal. But being illegal and actually have it not happen, I guess, are two different things.
Yeah, of course, because wildlife trade is a huge, huge worldwide problem. And I have heard that it comes second only to a worldwide drug trade. So it's a lot of money going into it. And as we know, if there is a demand, there will always be some sort of supply. So for us, it means that, for example, around here, we try to work with the population, we try to educate the people who live in those forests or around them, make them aware that these birds are actually much more even economically beneficial to them when they are still where they are. And because if you poach a nest and you sell the chicks, you will get some immediate income, of course, but if you keep the chicks where they are and take care of the forest, you can come and bring people birdwatching and checking them, basically viewing them, taking pictures of them forever if you take a good care of them.
You know,
there
is some ecotourism in Mexico, though, for sure. And I suspect you'd like to see more. But right now you could see the whale sharks at certain times of the year in certain places, you know, where they are. You can go whale watching, certainly, in again, certain places. Obviously, you have to be in a coastal town to go whale watching, but you could do that in parts of Mexico. And in addition, similarly, the sea turtles. Would you like to see the same kind of increase in ecotourism where there are rainforests to see animals like the parrots, the many species of monkeys, and some of the lizards and all those things that live in the rainforest?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it is happening. You're right. Some of these animals that you have been talking about, they have been attraction to many people for decades, like the whales in Puerto Vallarta. They arrive Every winter for a couple months, and there's a big industry that goes and whale watches. But in the birding, coming back, for example, to the parrots, you do see an increase in interest on part of people, and we do receive every year a lot of very avid bird watchers who basically don't do anything else but travel the world to see another species they haven't seen before. And we do have success stories in this sense as well. I could talk about one perfect example of a close friend of mine, Mexican people who have been living for generations in a forest not very far from Puerto Vallarta, and they always had a big population of green macaws, which is the largest parrot down here. And they had some problems with the poaching, and they started to solve the problem by basically guarding the forest with their presence and also hoisting up artificial nests, because these birds, they nest in large cavities, and large cavities are available only in large trees. And large trees are sometimes the first trees to go when somebody wants to come and chop a tree down. Mm-hmm. They started hoisting these artificial nests, and they were very successful. So now all of the nests are occupied, which is a great news.
Is this beneficial to them economically, or they're doing it because it's the right thing to do?
They definitely started because it's the right thing to do, and that's the absolutely, you know, amazing and encouraging part of it. Their prime motive wasn't financial, but obviously they are just people. They need to eat, they need to live somewhere, they need to send their kids to school. So they do take small groups of bird watchers to go and see these birds in the wild. They are not kept in any captivity or restricted in any way. They just know where these animals live, and they have their way of approaching them without disturbing them, and they know where they will be and at what time. So they're very successful in taking you into the forest and showing you these beautiful birds up close. So
there are examples all over the world of how ecotourism has saved specific species and certainly environments. And one example, very different than Mexico, is in Rwanda in Central Africa. The mountain gorillas were disappearing. And since tourists have come, the Rwandan people, and in Uganda the same, but particularly Rwanda, and the government have realized this is a huge amount of money that all these tourists are bringing in. That will also help us pay for infrastructure, help us pay for education for children, as well as infusing it in other ways into the local community. If we protect the gorillas, then we all benefit. Well, the same thing could happen in other places in the world, I think. And in some ways it has, for sure. There are lots of other examples. And in a sense, maybe, seeing whale sharks in various places, I think Cancun is primarily, or Playa del Carmen, where people see whale sharks, these amazing creatures as big as a house. They're sharks, but they're pretty benign, or they mean to be benign, but they're so big, you want to be careful. But I want to swim with them one day. That would be an amazing, like swimming with a school bus. I mean, they're huge. But that would be an amazing experience, you know, and a lot of people feel that way. They go down there to do that. That helps the local economy. Would you like to see more of that in Mexico?
Well, definitely. Of course. And did you know, Steve, that you can do this in Vallarta now as well?
Really?
Because we do have a resident population of whale sharks as well. It's just not very talked about. The spot that you are talking about is at the very northern tip of Yucatan Peninsula. So, yes, your destination probably would be Cancun, and from there you would drive up and go to a place called Holbox,
mm-hmm.
an island offshore. And in summer, they have a big migration of whale sharks. But I was lucky enough this February to go not very far from where I live, from Puerto Vallarta, up to the north, to the coast of Nayarit, only about 2 hours' drive from Puerto Vallarta. And there you can jump on a boat, again, just as you said, in the case of Yucatan, it is a community-run ecotourism. So all these families come from that place, and they know the place very well. And they have little boats, and they will take you out. And they will find sections where the food for the whale sharks is somehow concentrated because of currents and so forth. And they locate these animals, and you can jump in the water and swim with a, 20-foot-long whale shark. And that's exactly what we did. It was great.
Wow. Wow. Do you have pictures of that?
Yeah, I do. Yes. The challenge was, in my case, when it comes to the photos, that the amount of the krill and the plankton was such that the water wasn't very transparent. So the visibility wasn't great. It was just really a couple feet. So even more impressive it was when you finally got to the proximity of the animal and suddenly there it was, right? Huge and right in your face.
And they are as big as a school bus, right?
They are, yeah. They reach up to 20, 25 feet.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's
quite incredible, quite impressive. So, okay, we're talking about taking pictures. In your book, Amphibians, Reptiles, Birds, and Mammals of Western Mexico, it turns out you took about all the pictures in this book. I don't even know how you got some of these photographs. They're quite incredible. I mean, how you even found all these animals, including all these snakes and amphibians, some of them very, very rare. So give us some tips, sort of photography 101, nature photography 101. I suppose the first thing is you have to find what you're looking for.
Oh, you're very right about that, Steve. So exactly in this case, when you are trying to put together information about a certain group of animals, your primary objective is to obviously get them up close. Because when you are making a field guide, you not only want to get a nice picture of an animal, but you also have to take a photo in such a manner that the characteristics of the animal are easy to see and so forth. So, when it comes to snakes and the frogs, you really have to get your hands on them. So somehow capture them, or at least get very close. But some animals allow you, some animals won't. In this particular case, in the frog and the snakes, I had a great help of a few friends who practically didn't do anything else but chase after snakes and frogs. So that's the thing to do. If you are looking for a particular animal and you don't really have the know-how, your best bet is to find somebody who does and follow them. So I can tell you that when I went out the first night with these guys, I saw in the course of one night more snake than I had in my previous life put together. Can you believe that?
Wow. So what was the secret? they knew where to look or what?
Yeah, they know where to look, but they also, many people who spend a lot of time in the nature, fortunately these days I can, include myself after 17 years living here on the Western Coast, your brain kind of, you train your brain to recognize certain patterns in the forest, where a normal person wouldn't see anything, you immediately see an iguana or you immediately see a snake. So if you follow people that dedicate their lives to finding animals, you will see a lot of animals, for sure.
I've always said that. So I think that sometimes we walk by nature, even in an urban area out in a forest, maybe there's a raccoon out there or a possum or something, and we walk right by it. The animals don't generally want to stick up their paw and say, "Here I am," and we don't look up to see the birds that are in the trees necessarily. And knowing what to look for is part of the key as well.
Of course, but also wanting to look for. The particular case of me looking for animals because I needed photos of them for a field guide, that's kind of, not very many of us do that, but anyone who visits the nature or lives close to the nature should really work on being a little bit more open to what they see around themselves. It sounds kind of basic and no-brainer, but you see people who spend their lives in cities in environments that are not very close to nature anymore, and then you bring them in into a natural environment, and you somehow need to help them and teach them how to take it all in. And it doesn't take very long. It's kind of inside us. You just need to wake it up. And when that happens, it's great. You see the people having a great time.
I think it is great, too. How important is the camera that you choose? Or do you think sometimes that's overdone. I mean, to get the photos you get, you know, a professional photographer, I would assume you need an SLR camera, or maybe you don't.
Well, that would be kind of a very broad question, but I always say the best camera is the one that you have.
So
you
yes.
shouldn't worry about the camera you don't have, right? Because we all started, everyone I know started with very basic equipment. And it doesn't mean that you couldn't do a decent job. Obviously, you know, if you want to dedicate your life and nature photography, you will probably have to invest. But I think that the gear itself is probably a very minor part of what you will have to sacrifice, because it just takes a lot of time. And more than the gear that you are holding in your hand, it is really about you being out there, which is usually what costs us much more effort, being able to spend as much time in the nature as we possibly can. Obviously, good gear is better than bad gear. I don't want to downplay this. But if somebody likes taking pictures, they shouldn't get a lack of gear in their way. They should just grab whatever they have and go out and shoot and shoot and shoot and try to improve on what they, you know, were able to produce yesterday. So it's about the process. I think the process is the most enjoyable part of it anyway.
Does you know, so when I was a kid, you'd have to develop the film and do all those things. And if you took 5,000 pictures, you were paying for 5,000 pictures. Today, with digital cameras, you could take 1,000,000 pictures. And I guess, you know, so people have said, well, Steve, you have a very good eye. And maybe I do. But at the same time, what I'm also good at is just clicking more and more and more. Picture, picture, picture. And eventually the odds are something will turn out. Is there some truth to that? If you take enough photos, you'll get something.
Well, statistically, maybe. I wouldn't really sell this as a kind of how-to-do photography manual. The first step in photography, I think, is to be able to see. A lot of people take photos, and they don't really know what they are taking a picture of. So you somehow have to participate in that creative process. You cannot be just the finger on the shutter. You somehow have to know what it is that you are trying to achieve. And sometimes you will be able to squeeze it out, and sometimes you won't. And if you don't, then you probably should learn from that experience and improve. But you cannot approach photography as a machine gun, you know, kind of activity, really.
You mean to shoot?
Yeah. I mean, again, people who spend a lot of time taking pictures of animals or wildlife in general, they will take an immense amount of photos. Yes, that's true. But that's not their primary objective. They are not approaching the whole issue with this sort of attitude. Okay, let's take 20,000 pictures. Something will have to, come out.
That would be a lot. Is anticipation part of it? So knowing that you have a certain kind of bird that may fly up quickly and is going to be out of your sights, or a snake that you know will respond a certain way if you get close enough, which will also make it a good photo. I mean, does that anticipation and understanding what you're shooting, does that matter a lot or not so much?
Well, certain photos you can take only under certain conditions. And if these conditions do not exist, you somehow have to help creating them. But on the other hand, sometimes you will get only a split-second chance to achieve what you want to do, and sometimes you're lucky and sometimes you're not. So it's probably not a good enough answer, but you have to try your best at all the time. And, you're still dealing with nature, so sometimes it will work out and sometimes it will not.
Well, right. So here's where the question that I asked, I guess, was inappropriate in a way before, because you don't get a chance. I mean, maybe if you're in Africa and there's a herd of elephants, you get the chance to take that 40,000 photos. But for a little bird in a rainforest, with the light being only what it is for that moment, and you know that bird's going to fly away in 2 seconds, you might only have one shot.
Yeah, and you better be ready. So, yeah, obviously their experience helps. Their knowledge of your equipment helps and its limitations and its potential, because you might have only just that one snap, and you either get it or you won't. That's part of the game.
So you said it's part of the game. Is it kind of a game?
I think that too many of us it is. For a lot of people, I see game at least in the sense that we love it, so we enjoy it. Game is usually something that humans do to entertain themselves. So besides the benefits of our work, for example, nature photographer, to contribute to the general awareness of the beauty of nature that we have and the challenges that it's facing and so forth, these photos can be used as tools. We do enjoy what we do, absolutely. I don't think I know any nature photographer that actually doesn't love what they're doing.
Well, certainly you've gotten these amazing, amazing photos. And if you're at all interested in the wildlife of Mexico, especially Western Mexico, the book is called, again, Amphibians, Reptiles, Birds, and Mammals of Western Mexico. Petra Miska, M-Y-S-K-A, is the author. Petra, where can folks purchase the book?
Okay, the easiest thing is to go to the internet and Google Viva Natura. Viva Natura is basically my brand, and if you do that, you will not only find my website, but you will also find the book on Amazon or on Google Books, or you can find the book in electronic form as a Kindle, or you can also buy my apps. All these products have a fairly similar content. They deal with the amphibians, reptiles, birds, and mammals of Western Mexico, but they're just being approached through different channels. So just go to Viva Natura on Google, and you will find it.
All right. Well, great conversation. I appreciate your time. And, you know, I love Mexico. Is such a wonderful place. And I think that people who go there even don't get the full experience of what this great country is indeed all about. So muchas gracias, mi amigo.
De nada. Thank you. Okay. It was a pleasure.